A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about the gap between the ideal home network and what's actually possible in a rental. We've talked plenty about wired backhaul being the gold standard, but for millions of people, drilling holes and running Cat 6 through walls is a non-starter. The landlord won't allow it, or the building's concrete, or you're on the third floor and your router's in the basement. So he's asking, what does the realistic alternative actually look like? And more importantly, what does it cost to make it not terrible?
This is the tension that practically every renter hits eventually. You read the forums, you watch the YouTube videos, everyone says wired backhaul is the only way, and they're not wrong, but they're also not paying your security deposit. So you end up in this blended approach, one access point you can actually wire, and then bridges or wireless hops for everything else. The question is whether that setup can actually deliver, or whether you're just building an expensive compromise that leaves you staring at buffering icons.
And Daniel's not asking in the abstract. He's got specifics. Wi-Fi 7 access point pricing right now. What kind of real-world throughput you can expect on a gigabit or 2.5 gigabit line. And then this whole other problem he flagged that I think is genuinely under-discussed.
The bridge problem.
The bridge problem. Dedicated Wi-Fi to Ethernet bridges. Actual standalone units that take a wireless signal and spit out wired Ethernet without also trying to be a repeater, a mesh node, and a smart speaker are surprisingly hard to find. It's a blind spot in the consumer networking market, and it creates a bottleneck that can waste your entire Wi-Fi 7 investment before you've even streamed a single frame of video.
This is where I get frustrated with the industry, because the components exist, the chipsets exist, but nobody's packaging them into a product that just does this one thing well. Instead, you get these combo units where bridging is buried in some advanced settings menu like an afterthought, and the firmware hasn't been updated since the Obama administration.
There are really three bottlenecks to think about here. One, the access point itself. What does a decent Wi-Fi 7 unit cost, and what can it actually push through the air in a real apartment with neighbors and interference and walls? Two, the bridge hardware. What's available, what's affordable, and does it even support the standard you need? And three, the quality trap. You can have a beautiful Wi-Fi 7 AP mounted in the perfect spot, but if the bridge on the other end has a crummy receiver and negotiates at Wi-Fi 6 speeds, you've just paid a premium for performance you'll never see.
It's like building a highway with 8 lanes and then putting a toll booth at the end with one guy manually making change.
Daniel specifically mentioned his Synology NAS, which doesn't have built-in Wi-Fi, most don't, and the dilemma of needing it somewhere that Ethernet can't reach. That's the exact use case where a bridge is mandatory, and where bridge quality stops being theoretical, and starts being whether your file transfer is actually complete.
He wants concrete recommendations, specific bridge devices, specific APs, a real build-out with costs. Not just buy good stuff and hope for the best. So that's what we're going to do. Walk through the actual shopping list, the actual throughput numbers, and the actual trade-offs you're signing up for.
The blended approach isn't a compromise you settle for. It's a design problem with its own constraints and its own solutions. The question is whether those solutions are good enough yet.
Let's start by defining what we actually mean by a blended approach, because the term gets thrown around, and half the time people are just describing a mesh system with extra steps.
A mesh system with wireless backhaul is not what we're talking about here. That's a whole different animal with its own set of problems. Band sharing, the half-duplex penalty, nodes competing for airtime. We did a whole episode on why mesh isn't the silver bullet people think it is.
Episode 185, The Mesh Myth. And the core problem hasn't changed. When your mesh nodes talk to each other wirelessly, they're using the same radio spectrum your devices are using. Every hop cuts your throughput roughly in half. Two hops and you're down to a quarter of what the main node is getting. It's a physics problem, not a marketing problem.
What Daniel's describing is different. He wants a single access point, ideally the one place in the apartment where he can actually plug something in, and then dedicated bridges that convert Wi-Fi back to Ethernet at the device end. The bridge isn't repeating the signal for other devices. It's just a client, pulling data from the AP and handing it off to a wired device.
That distinction matters enormously. A repeater or mesh node has to receive, buffer, and retransmit, which is where the half-duplex penalty comes from. A bridge in client mode just receives, then sends the data out over Ethernet. Full duplex on the wired side. No retransmission on the wireless side beyond what the protocol requires. You're not having anything.
The three pillars of viability for this approach. Pillar 1. The access point has to deliver enough speed and range to serve multiple bridges simultaneously. Pillar 2. The bridges have to exist, be affordable, and actually work in dedicated bridge mode. Pillar 3. The bridge quality has to be high enough that it's not the bottleneck, because if you pair a $300 Wi-Fi 7 AP with a $20 bridge from a brand you've never heard of, you've built a very expensive way to get terrible performance.
That third pillar is where I see people stumble constantly. They'll research the AP for weeks, read every review, compare beamforming patterns, and then grab whatever bridge is cheapest on Amazon because they've run out of energy for decisions. The bridge is an afterthought, and then they're surprised when their NAS transfers crawl.
The bridge is not an afterthought. The bridge is half the link.
Every packet your AP transmits has to be received by something. If that something has a weak antenna, an old Wi-Fi standard, and a chipset that overheats under sustained load, it doesn't matter how good your AP is. The link negotiates down to the weakest participant.
Let's get into the first piece of the puzzle, the access point itself. What does a decent Wi-Fi 7 AP cost right now? And what can it actually deliver in a real apartment?
I've been tracking this. The TP-Link EAP773 is around $80. The Ubiquiti U7 Pro is about $190. These are ceiling mount units designed for small business or prosumer use, not the consumer all-in-one routers that try to also be a sculpture. You're paying for radios and antennas, not for a plastic housing that looks like a dead spider.
$180 for an AP is not nothing, but it's also not insane for something that's going to be the backbone of your network for the next 5 years. Compare it to what people spend on phones.
The spec sheet on these things is impressive. Wi-Fi 7 brings 320 MHz channels, 4K QAM modulation, and multi-link operation. The theoretical maximum is over 5 gigabits per second, in a lab, with no walls, and no neighbors, and a client device that also supports all those features perfectly.
Which is not the apartment any of us live in.
Real world, with interference from neighboring networks, with a couple of walls, with client devices that are maybe Wi-Fi 6E at best, you're looking at more like 1.5 to 2.5 gigabits per second of actual throughput. Still enough to fully saturate a gigabit internet line, and enough to make good use of a 2.5 gigabit line, but not 5.
That's fine. The point isn't to hit the theoretical maximum. The point is to not be the bottleneck. If your internet is 1 gigabit and your AP can push 1.5 to 2.5 through the air, the AP is not the weak link.
The weak link is going to be the bridge, which brings us to the hard part.
The bridge market is bizarre. If you search for Wi-Fi to Ethernet bridge on any retailer, you get a mess of results. Range extenders that happen to have an Ethernet port. Mesh nodes that can be configured as clients if you dig through 3 levels of advanced settings. Travel routers that technically work, but weren't designed for permanent installation. Actual dedicated bridges are rare, and the ones that exist are often poorly documented.
This is the blind spot Daniel mentioned, and he's absolutely right. The consumer networking industry has decided that what people want is mesh. Mesh is the product category. Mesh is what gets the marketing budget. A bridge is just a mesh node that you've decided not to use as a mesh node, and the manufacturers treat it that way.
What's the market logic?
1. Mesh locks you into an ecosystem. If you buy an Eero mesh system, you're probably going to buy Eero nodes for it. Bridges are interoperable. Any bridge that speaks standard Wi-Fi can connect to any AP. There's no lock-in, so there's less incentive to develop them. 2. A bridge is a simpler product from a bill of materials perspective, but it requires better engineering to do well. You need a good receiver, a clean firmware implementation that doesn't add latency, and antennas that are actually designed for sustained throughput rather than just coverage area. that engineering costs money and it's harder to market than covers 5,000 square feet.
You end up with a market full of extenders that do a mediocre job of bridging, and almost nothing that does it well.
The TP-Link RE605X is probably the most commonly recommended bridge in the budget category. It's a Wi-Fi 6 unit, about $60. You can configure it in client mode, which is effectively a bridge. It connects to your AP wirelessly and provides Ethernet out. Real-world throughput maxes out around 600 megabits per second. That's enough for streaming, enough for light NAS use, but it's not going to give you full gigabit.
That's Wi-Fi 6. We're talking about pairing it with a Wi-Fi 7 AP.
Which is the quality trap in action. Your Wi-Fi 7 AP is capable of multi-gigabit throughput. Your Wi-Fi 6 bridge can only negotiate at Wi-Fi 6 speeds. The link drops to the lowest common denominator. You're leaving more than half the AP's potential on the table before you've even plugged anything in.
Are there any Wi-Fi 7 bridges available yet?
As of mid-2026, the bridge market hasn't caught up to Wi-Fi 7. There are Wi-Fi 7 mesh systems where you could theoretically configure a node as a bridge, but dedicated bridge hardware with Wi-Fi 7 radios is essentially non-existent at the consumer level. You're buying Wi-Fi 6 or 6E and accepting the gap.
The practical advice right now is, buy the Wi-Fi 7 AP for future-proofing and for the devices that can connect directly, but accept that your bridges are going to be Wi-Fi 6 or 6E for the foreseeable future.
Plan your throughput expectations accordingly. With a Wi-Fi 6 bridge, you're looking at 500 to 800 megabits per second real world, depending on distance, interference, and the specific hardware. That's fine for a smart TV streaming 4K. It's borderline for a NAS if you're moving large files regularly. It's not going to make you happy if you're trying to edit video off the NAS.
Let's talk about the NAS specifically, because this is where bridge quality stops being academic. Daniel mentioned his Synology unit. A DS224 Plus is about $300, no built-in Wi-Fi. If that NAS has to live somewhere without Ethernet, the bridge is the only thing standing between it and the rest of the network, and NAS traffic is sensitive. It's not like streaming, where a buffer can smooth over hiccups. File transfers don't tolerate packet loss gracefully. A cheap bridge with a bad chipset can cause timeouts, slow transfers, or in the worst case, silent corruption.
This is where the chipset actually matters. The Realtek RTL8832BR is a common mid-range Wi-Fi 6 chipset that shows up in a lot of bridges. It's not the fastest, but it's stable. It handles sustained throughput without overheating or dropping connections. If you're putting a bridge on a NAS, that's the kind of silicon you want, not the absolute cheapest thing with an Ethernet port, but something with a track record of not falling over under load.
There's an enterprise option that's worth mentioning just because the used market exists. The Ruckus ZoneFlex 7731 was a purpose-built wireless bridge from a few years back. It's overkill for most homes, but you can find them used for reasonable prices, and they were designed from the ground up for exactly this job, not as an afterthought in a mesh product line.
Ruckus gear is bulletproof. The antenna design alone is worth the price of admission. But it's older hardware, it's Wi-Fi 5, and you're going to be capping out around 300 to 400 megabits. Fine for a smart TV, probably not what you want for a NAS in 2026.
We're in this awkward transitional period. Wi-Fi 7 APs are available and reasonably priced. Wi-Fi 7 bridges are not. The market is forcing you into a mixed standard setup, and you have to decide whether to buy now and live with Wi-Fi 6 bridges, or wait and hope the bridge market catches up.
I don't think waiting is the right call if you need a solution now. The Wi-Fi 7 AP is still worth it. Your phones and laptops will benefit from it directly, and when Wi-Fi 7 bridges do eventually appear, you can swap them in without touching the AP. The AP is the long-term investment. The bridges are replaceable.
Let's walk through a concrete build-out, because that's what Daniel asked for. One Wi-Fi 7 AP, say the TP-Link EAP773 at $180. Three bridges. Let's use the TP-Link RE605X at $60 each, so $180 total for bridges. One Synology DS224 Plus NAS at $300, connected via one of the bridges. A smart TV connected via a second bridge. And maybe a desktop or a gaming console on the third bridge.
total hardware cost, about $660. Compare that to running Ethernet, which is $0 if it's impossible, or maybe $200 for a professional cable run if your landlord even allows it. And compare it to a high-end mesh system with dedicated wireless backhaul, like the Orbi 970, which runs over $1,200.
The blended approach is the middle path. It's not as good as wired backhaul, but it's substantially cheaper than the premium mesh systems, and in a lot of cases, it'll perform better because you're not dealing with the multi-hop penalty.
And this is the but that Daniel's whole question hangs on. It only works if you're careful about the bridges. If you buy the cheapest thing with an Ethernet port, you will be disappointed. The bridge is not a commodity. The chipset, the antenna design, the firmware quality, all of it matters.
There's another factor. Multiple bridges on one AP create contention. Every bridge is a client competing for airtime. Wi-Fi 7 has multi-link operation, which lets devices use multiple bands simultaneously, but that only helps if both the AP and the bridge support MLO. In mid-2026, MLO support in bridge-class hardware is basically non-existent.
Your three bridges are all sharing the AP's available airtime. With Wi-Fi 6 bridges on a Wi-Fi 7 AP, you're probably looking at 500 to 800 megabits per bridge in real-world conditions, assuming reasonable distance and not too much interference. More than that, if you're lucky, less if you've got concrete walls.
If you need more than three bridges, the math starts to get unfavorable. One AP with five bridges is going to show diminishing returns. The airtime gets sliced thinner and thinner. At that point, you'd want to consider a second AP, ideally wired or at least a mesh node with dedicated wireless backhaul to distribute the load.
Let's pull all of this into something actionable. If you're building a blended setup right now, mid-2026, here's what you do. Buy a Wi-Fi 7 AP. Except that your bridges will be Wi-Fi 6 or 6E. Plan for 500 to 800 megabits per bridge. For a NAS specifically, prioritize a bridge with a known good chipset, the Realtek RTL8832BR or the Broadcom BCM67566, and make absolutely sure you're configuring it in dedicated bridge or client mode, not as an extender. Extender mode halves your throughput immediately.
If you're buying bridges, look for ones that explicitly document bridge mode in the manual. If the manufacturer can't be bothered to tell you how to use the product for its most basic function, the firmware is probably not going to be great either.
The Netgear WAX 206 in bridge mode is another option. It's about $100. It's overkill for this use case, but it works and it's stable. The TP-Link RE605X is the budget pick at $60. Neither is Wi-Fi 7. Neither will give you full gigabit, but they'll get you a solid, stable connection that doesn't fall apart under load.
That's the real standard here. Not does it hit the theoretical maximum. Does it stay up? Does it not drop packets? Does it let you watch a movie and transfer a file at the same time without either one falling over?
The blended approach works. It's not set and forget. You need to test, tweak, and accept that you're leaving some performance on the table. But for renters, for people in constrained spaces, for anyone who can't just drill holes and run cable, it's the difference between a network that's frustrating and a network that's functional.
The open question is whether the market will ever actually serve this need. Wi-Fi 7 bridges should exist. The silicon is there. The demand is there. But the consumer networking industry has spent years convincing everyone that mesh is the answer, and bridges don't fit that story.
My guess is we'll see Wi-Fi 7 bridges start to appear in late 2027, probably from the enterprise side first, trickling down to consumer pricing a year after that. Until then, we're hacking together solutions from hardware that wasn't quite designed for the job, which, honestly, is kind of the renter networking experience in a nutshell.
Daniel's build-out, the $660 version, is a real plan. It's not theoretical. You can buy all of that today, set it up in an afternoon, and have a network that handles streaming, NAS access, and general use without making you want to throw things. It won't win any speed tests against a fully wired setup, but it'll work.
If you're listening to this and thinking $660 is a lot, I get it. But spread that over the 5 years you'll use this equipment, and it's about $11 a month for a network that actually works. Compare that to what you pay for the internet connection itself.
The last thing I'll say is, check your Bridges chipset. It sounds nerdy. It sounds like the kind of thing only Herman cares about. But it's the single biggest predictor of whether your setup will be stable or whether you'll be rebooting Bridges every 3 days. A $60 bridge with a good chipset will outperform an $80 bridge with a bad one. Don't buy based on the antenna count on the box.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1920s, Icelandic fishermen used a knot called the Togmer's Knutur, literally fathom knot, which was treated with a tar mixture containing copper sulfate to prevent rot in North Atlantic waters. The copper sulfate made the rope fibers slightly acidic over time, which actually increased the knot's holding strength as the fibers etched and locked together.
The knot got stronger by slowly destroying itself. A metaphor for something, I'm sure.
That's deeply unsettling, and I'm not going to think about it.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you've got a networking question that's been keeping you up at night, send it to the show at show@weirdprompts.com. We'll dig into it.
The thing I want to nail down before we get into specific hardware is why this isn't just mesh with a different label. Because if you walk into a Best Buy and describe this problem, the salesperson is going to point you at a 3-pack of mesh nodes and send you on your way.
That salesperson isn't being malicious. Mesh is the default answer the industry has settled on. But the problem with mesh wireless backhaul is structural, not situational. Every node that isn't wired is using the same radio spectrum to talk to the main node that your devices are using to talk to it. You're splitting airtime between backhaul and client traffic.
Then the half-duplex penalty stacks on top of that. A mesh node has to receive a packet, buffer it, wait for clear air, and retransmit. That's not a software inefficiency, that's how Wi-Fi works at the protocol level. A bridge in client mode doesn't retransmit. It receives, hands the data off to Ethernet, and it's done. The wired side is full duplex, the wireless side is just a client connection.
Daniel's blended approach is really three requirements stacked on top of each other. The access point has to push enough bandwidth to serve multiple bridges without choking. The bridges have to exist as actual products you can buy without digging through enterprise catalogs. And the bridge quality has to be high enough that you're not building a multi-gigabit highway that dead ends at a dirt road.
That third one is where the whole thing lives or dies. You can spec out a perfect AP. You can find bridges that technically work. But if the bridge's receiver is garbage, or its chipset thermal throttles under sustained load, or its firmware adds 50 milliseconds of latency for no reason, congratulations, you've built an expensive way to replicate a bad powerline adapter.
The frustrating part is that this isn't a technology problem. The silicon exists. The antenna designs exist. It's a product category problem. Nobody's packaging it.
The bridge market is strange. I spent a couple of hours digging through product listings before we recorded, and the number of devices that are actually marketed as Wi-Fi to Ethernet bridge. Not as an extender with an Ethernet port, not as a mesh node you can reconfigure, is tiny. Maybe a dozen products total across all the major brands, and half of those are discontinued.
Which is wild when you think about how many devices still ship without Wi-Fi. Most desktop PCs, game consoles that people swear work fine on wireless until they don't, printers that are already punishment enough without adding Wi-Fi negotiation to the experience.
The thing is, a bridge is conceptually simpler than a mesh node. It's got one job, receive Wi-Fi, output Ethernet, no repeating, no band steering, no client handoff logic. So why is the market so thin?
You mentioned ecosystem lock-in before, but I think there's something else. A bridge is invisible in a way that a mesh node isn't. You plug it in behind a NAS or under a TV cabinet and you never think about it again. There's no app to open, no speed test to run, no coverage map to admire. It either works or it doesn't. That's a hard product to build a brand around.
It's a hard product to upsell. If you sell someone a 3-pack of mesh nodes, you've sold them 3 devices that all need to be from the same ecosystem. If you sell someone a bridge, you've sold them one device that works with whatever AP they already have. The lifetime value math is terrible for the manufacturer.
What's actually available if you need a bridge right now? You mentioned the TP-Link RE605X at $60 and the Netgear WAX 206 at around $100.
There's the ASUS RPAX58, which is technically an extender but has a dedicated media bridge mode that works reasonably well, about $70. The D-Link DAP-X 1870 also has a bridge mode buried in its settings, similar price point. And then there's a handful of travel routers. The GL.INET, Barrel AX, the TP-Link TLWR902 AC that can be configured as bridges and are actually quite good at it because they're designed for exactly this use case, connect to hotel Wi-Fi, share it over Ethernet.
A travel router is a permanent bridge. That's the kind of hack that defines renter networking.
It works, though. INET units in particular have good MediaTek chipsets and the firmware is actively maintained. They're $40 to $70 depending on the model. The downside is they're Wi-Fi 6, not 6E, so you're capped at the 5 GHz band with no 6 GHz option.
That matters, because the 6 GHz band is where Wi-Fi 6E and Wi-Fi 7 get a lot of their clean throughput. If your bridge can't see 6 GHz, it's fighting for space on the increasingly crowded 5 GHz band with every neighbor's router.
And this gets to the actual throughput question Daniel asked. What's the real difference between a dedicated bridge and a mesh node forced into bridge mode? The answer depends on what the mesh node is doing under the hood. A mesh node in bridge mode, if the firmware is well implemented, should behave almost identically to a dedicated bridge. It's receiving, not retransmitting.
Because the firmware was written for mesh first.
The mesh firmware is optimized for the multi-hop case. It's got all this logic for deciding when to forward packets, when to hold them, how to handle client roaming. When you put it in bridge mode, some of that logic stays active, even if it shouldn't. Extra processing cycles, extra latency, sometimes extra buffer bloat. A dedicated bridge has none of that. It's a thinner software stack, and in networking, thinner is almost always faster.
How much latency are we talking about?
In practice, a good dedicated bridge might add 1 to 3 milliseconds. A mesh node in bridge mode can add 5 to 15. It doesn't sound like much, but if you're running a NAS over that connection, those milliseconds compound across every packet in a file transfer. A gigabyte file is millions of packets. The difference between 3 milliseconds and 15 milliseconds of added latency per packet is the difference between a transfer that feels snappy and one that feels like it's wading through mud.
That's before we even get to the half-duplex problem. Walk through what happens when someone buys a cheap extender with an Ethernet port and calls it a bridge.
A typical extender, not in bridge mode, just in its default configuration, receives a packet from the AP, buffers it, and then retransmits it on the same channel. That retransmission step means the extender is talking while the AP is also trying to talk. They're sharing airtime. Every packet takes two transmissions to reach the wired device, one from the AP to the extender, one from the extender to, well, in this case, to the Ethernet port. But the extender doesn't know that. It's still doing the retransmission dance.
Your throughput gets halved before the packet even reaches the wire.
Halved in ideal conditions. In practice, with interference and contention, it can be worse. A dedicated bridge in client mode skips the retransmission entirely. The AP transmits, the bridge receives, the bridge puts it on Ethernet. Full airtime efficiency.
This is why Daniel's question about bridge quality isn't just about speed ratings. A bridge that says 1200 megabits on the box, but operates in extender mode, is going to deliver less usable throughput than a bridge that says 800 megabits, but runs in true client mode with a clean firmware stack.
The spec sheet is lying to you, not technically. The radio can physically modulate at that rate, but the software architecture means you'll never see it. It's like buying a sports car that ships with a governor limiting it to 55 miles per hour. The engine's capable, but the system won't let you use it.
If you're Daniel, standing in front of a product listing trying to figure out whether something is a real bridge or just an extender with an Ethernet port, what do you look for?
1. The manual. If the setup guide shows a client mode or media bridge mode as a distinct configuration option, not just extender mode and access point mode, that's a good sign. 2. The Ethernet port spec. If it's a 100 megabit port, walk away. That's a dead giveaway that the manufacturer never intended anyone to use it for serious bridging. 3. The firmware update history. If the last firmware update was in 2021, the bridge mode is probably an afterthought that never got optimized.
The 100 megabit port on a device marketed for gigabit Wi-Fi is one of those details that makes me irrationally angry. Somebody in a product meeting looked at the bill of materials and said they won't notice.
They notice when their NAS transfers crawl. They might not know why, but they notice.
Let's talk about the router in bridge mode question, because that's the other thing people try. They've got an old router sitting in a closet. They've heard it can be configured as a bridge, and they figure free is better than $60.
Sometimes it works. DDWRT and OpenWrt can turn a lot of old routers into perfectly competent bridges. The problem is that consumer router hardware is not designed for this thermally. A router in bridge mode is running its radios at full power continuously. It's not just handling the occasional burst of web traffic, it's sustaining a link. Older routers overheat, throttle, or just drop the connection after a few hours of sustained load.
The Wi-Fi standard on that old router is probably Wi-Fi 5, maybe Wi-Fi 6 if it's relatively recent. You're back to the quality trap. Pairing a Wi-Fi 7 AP with a Wi-Fi 5 bridge.
Wi-Fi 5 maxes out around 300 to 400 megabits real world in good conditions. You're leaving 80% of your AP's capability on the table. Free isn't free if it costs you most of your throughput.
The practical recommendation is, if you need a bridge today, buy something that was designed this decade. Supports at least Wi-Fi.
We've got the AP and the bridge hardware mapped out. Now the part that actually determines whether this whole thing works or falls apart, bridge quality as the hidden bottleneck. And I mean hidden literally. You can't see it on a spec sheet.
A Wi-Fi 7 AP pushing 2 gigabits through the air, and a bridge on the other end that can only negotiate at Wi-Fi 6 speeds. The link doesn't average out. It drops to the slower device's ceiling.
That ceiling is lower than most people realize. A Wi-Fi 6 bridge connected to a Wi-Fi 7 AP will negotiate entirely at Wi-Fi 6 rates. Real world, that's about 1.2 gigabits absolute max. And in practice with a wall or two, more like 600 to 800 megabits. You've just lost over half of what the AP is capable of delivering.
The AP is screaming into a void. All that beamforming, all that 4K QAM modulation, the 320 megahertz channels, none of it matters because the bridge can't speak the language.
It's not just the Wi-Fi generation. The receiver quality on the bridge is equally important. A cheap bridge with a single internal antenna and a noisy front-end amplifier is going to have a much weaker signal-to-noise ratio than a well-designed unit with external antennas or a properly engineered internal array. Weaker signal means lower modulation rates, more retransmissions, more airtime wasted on error correction.
You're losing throughput twice. Once because the standard is older, and again because the radio is mediocre.
This is the part that doesn't show up in Amazon reviews. Nobody's running iPerf tests on their bridge before posting a 5-star rating. They plug it in, their smart TV works, they're happy. But for a NAS, where you're moving gigabytes of data, the difference between a good receiver and a bad one is the difference between a transfer finishing in 10 minutes versus timing out entirely.
Let's put numbers on the build-out Daniel asked for. TP-Link EAP773, AP $180. 3 TP-Link RE605X bridges, 60 each, so 180. Synology, DS224 plus NAS, $300, connected via one of those bridges. Smart TV on a second bridge, maybe a desktop on the third. Total, $660.
Compare that to what running Ethernet costs in a rental, which is either $0 because it's impossible, or $200 for a professional install that your landlord might veto. And compare it to the Orbi 970 mesh system at over $1,200, which still has wireless backhaul penalties. The blended approach is the rational middle ground.
The NAS on a bridge is the stress test. Synology units don't have Wi-Fi built in. Daniel's doesn't. None of the disk station line does. So the bridge isn't optional. And NAS traffic is unforgiving. Streaming video has buffers. File transfers don't. A bridge that drops packets under sustained load will cause SMB timeouts, stalled transfers, and, in edge cases, file system errors if you're writing directly to the NAS.
This is where I tell people to look at the chipset. The Realtek RTL8832BR is the one that shows up in most mid-range Wi-Fi 6 bridges that are actually stable. It's not exotic. It's not the fastest thing on the market. But it handles sustained throughput without thermal throttling, and its driver stack is mature enough that you're not dealing with weird firmware bugs that drop connections after 4 hours.
The alternative for the truly paranoid is used enterprise gear. The Ruckus ZoneFlex 7731 was a purpose. Built wireless bridge, not a repurposed mesh node, not an extender with bridge mode buried in a menu. It was designed to do exactly this job. You can find them used for reasonable prices, but they're Wi-Fi 5, so you're capping out around 300 to 400 megabits. Stable as a rock, but not fast.
For a smart TV that's streaming compressed video, 300 megabits is more than enough. For a NAS, it's painful. So the Ruckus route only makes sense if you're bridging low bandwidth devices and you value stability above all else.
The other knock-on effect that nobody thinks about until they've already bought everything. Multiple bridges on one AP create contention. Every bridge is a client competing for airtime. The AP can only talk to one client at a time on a given channel. Three bridges means three clients, all trying to get their packets through.
Wi-Fi 7's multi-link operation is supposed to help here. MLO lets devices use multiple bands simultaneously. The AP could be talking to bridge 1 on 5 GHz while simultaneously sending data to bridge 2 on 6 GHz. It's clever. The problem is that both ends need to support it, and in mid-2026, MLO support in bridge-class hardware is essentially zero.
Your three bridges are all fighting for time on the same band, same channel, same AP radio. With Wi-Fi 6 bridges on a Wi-Fi 7 AP, real-world throughput per bridge in a three-bridge setup is probably 500 to 800 megabits each, assuming decent signal and not too much neighbor interference.
If you push it to five bridges, the airtime gets sliced thin enough that you'll notice. Streaming might still work, but NAS transfers will crawl, and anything latency-sensitive like video calls or online gaming will get jittery. The practical limit for a single AP serving bridges is around 3 or 4, depending on how much traffic each one is pushing.
The question Daniel's really asking, whether to buy Wi-Fi 6E bridges now or wait for Wi-Fi 7, has a practical answer. Wi-Fi 7 bridges aren't coming in the next 12 months. The silicon exists, but the product category is too niche for manufacturers to prioritize. You'll be waiting until at least late 2027, and probably paying a premium when they do arrive.
In the meantime, a Wi-Fi 6 or 6E bridge at 500 to 800 megabits is totally usable for the devices Daniel's talking about. A smart TV streaming 4K needs maybe 25 megabits. A NAS doing file transfers will fill the ceiling, but for backups and media serving, it's fine. It's not full gigabit, but it's not broken either.
When Wi-Fi 7 bridges do eventually show up, the throughput per bridge should jump to somewhere around 1 to 1.5 gigabits real world. That's when the blended approach stops being a compromise and starts being competitive with wired backhaul for everything short of a data center.
That's the future state. For now, the $660 build-out, Wi-Fi 7 AP, 3 Wi-Fi 6 bridges, NAS, TV, is the realistic plan. It won't win any speed test competitions against a fully wired house, but it'll handle streaming, file transfers, and general use without making you want to throw the whole setup out the window.
The bridge is not an afterthought. It's half the link. And if you treat it like a commodity, it'll treat your throughput like a suggestion.
Here's the shopping list distilled down. 1. Buy a Wi-Fi 7 AP. The TP-Link EAP773 at $180 or the Ubiquiti U7 Pro at $190. Don't overthink this. Either one will do the job. 2. Accept that your bridges are going to be Wi-Fi 6 or 6E for the foreseeable future. That means planning for 500 to 800 megabits per bridge, not full gigabit.
That number is fine for what Daniel's actually doing. Streaming 4K needs 25 megabits. NAS file transfers will feel the ceiling, but for backups and media serving, it's more than adequate. The only thing it won't handle gracefully is real-time video editing off the NAS, and if you're doing that in a rental, you've got bigger problems than bridge selection.
3. For the NAS specifically, chipset matters more than brand. Look for the Realtek RTL8832BR or the Broadcom BCM6756. These show up in the TP-Link RE605X, the ASUS RPAX58 in MediaBridge mode, and several GL.ENET travel routers. If the product page doesn't list the chipset, check the open VERT hardware table. It's the most reliable cross-reference.
When you're setting it up, do not leave it in extender mode. Extender mode halves your throughput instantly. You want client mode or media bridge mode, whatever the manufacturer calls it. The key is that the device receives Wi-Fi and outputs Ethernet without retransmitting.
4. If you need more than 3 bridges, don't just keep adding them to the same AP. The airtime contention gets ugly. At that point, add a second AP, wired if you can swing it, or a Wi-Fi 7 mesh node running in wireless backhaul mode to split the load. One AP per three bridges is the rule of thumb.
The total for Daniel's three-bridge build-out, AP, three bridges, NAS, lands around $660. That's the number to beat. And the only things that beat it are impossible. Wired runs or mesh systems that cost twice as much and still have wireless backhaul penalties.
The thing I keep coming back to is whether this market gap is permanent or just a timing problem. Wi-Fi 7 is showing up in phones and laptops now. The client base is building. At some point, manufacturers have to notice that there are millions of devices, NAS units, desktops, game consoles, smart TVs, sitting there with Ethernet ports and no Wi-Fi radio, and the only way to connect them is a bridge that nobody's making.
The cynical read is that they have noticed, and they'd rather sell you a whole mesh system you don't need. A bridge is a one-time $60 purchase that works with any AP. A mesh node is $150 and only works with the rest of the system. The incentives are not subtle.
My guess, and this is a guess, is that we'll see the first consumer Wi-Fi 7 bridges sometime in late 2027, probably from TP-Link or ASUS, probably priced around $100 to $120, and they'll be good. The silicon is ready. The antenna designs are understood. It's purely a question of whether someone decides the market is big enough to justify the production run.
Until then, renters are stuck playing hardware mix and match. Wi-Fi 7 AP on one end, Wi-Fi 6 bridge on the other, and a gap in the middle you just have to accept. It's not elegant. But $660 for a setup that handles streaming, NAS access, and general use without constant headaches, that's not a bad deal.
The one thing I'd say to anyone building this out, test it. Don't just plug everything in and assume it's fine. Run a sustained file transfer from your NAS through the bridge. Watch for speed drops after 10 or 15 minutes. That's thermal throttling. Check your bridge's admin panel for packet errors. If you're seeing retransmission rates above a few percent, reposition the bridge or try a different channel.
The blended approach isn't set and forget. It's a system you tune. But the tuning is the difference between a network that frustrates you every day and one you forget exists. And for most people in rentals, forgetting the network exists is the highest compliment you can pay it.
Check your bridge's chipset. If you're running something with a no-name radio and firmware from 2021, you're leaving performance on the table. A $60 bridge with a Realtek or Broadcom chipset and current firmware will outperform an $80 mystery box every time.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you're running a blended setup that's actually working, or one that's driving you crazy, we want to hear about it. Email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.